History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to take a little initiative and invest a little time. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves truly inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. And before we hear from this week's guest with his words, I want you to get a taste of what he's been doing at sporting events for years. The Star-Spangled Banner on harmonica is one thing. Knowing that the guy playing it is a 94-year-old Navy veteran makes it mean a little bit more. And we're going to enjoy a fascinating conversation today with Jake Griego. Well, first of all, Jake, we're here on El Pueblo Road in Los Ranchos de Albuquerque. You've lived your whole life on this road except for that Navy service, is that right?
That's correct, yes. I was born in 1930. I was here for 18 years, then I joined the Navy. I joined the Navy for a year because they had the draft going, and I felt that I'm going to get away from the draft. I'll join the Navy for 1 year. That's it. No more. Well, North Korea had news for me. I was in the reserves, and they started the war, so they pulled me back in for 2 more years.
Well, I want to ask you about that, but I'm interested in what things were like before that. So if I'm driving down El Pueblo Road now, I have an easy time finding your house because your carpentry skills and the things you've built out there. In fact, there's a mannequin stand and watch with a machine gun right over your driveway. Never seen that before. But what was this area like in the 1930s when you were growing up? What do you remember about your childhood here?
There was a lot of... I mostly farm. I was born during the Depression. I think people were still feeling the effects of the Depression when I was 8, 9 years old. But we were lucky. We had a big farm, like you heard from my brother Leo. So we never went hungry. We had plenty to eat. We didn't have much money, but we had the essentials. We had the chickens and hogs and horses. We had it real good. We used to sell fruit, and we used to sell it in places where, like the place like Martinez Town, those people were very poor. We would sell fruit there, and I remember some of the kids would come out barefooted, and my dad would say, just give them something, you know. We were lucky that we were born in the farm, you know.
And you mentioned your brother Leo, who I had the privilege of interviewing several years ago. You're the third brother, and you had two older brothers serving in World War II. Give me a taste of what those two did from your perspective and what it was like for you being back home while they're on the other side of the world.
Well, my older brother went from Normandy all the way to the Battle of the Bulge, all the way through France, Germany, and met the Russians in Czechoslovakia and came back. He was very lucky to come back without a scratch. And my other brother Leo, as you talked to, as you know, he was wounded in the Marine Corps, and he came back alive, thanks.
So you're a boy growing up here in Albuquerque. I mean, when Pearl Harbor happens, you're only 11. And I bet you remember that. You remember that day when you found out what happened over there?
I sure do remember. I remember it like it better have been a few years ago, because the action of the older people, you know, they were scared. They thought the Japanese were going to come to California and then keep coming in New Mexico. And that's the thought then. Yeah, but I remember it very, very well. But you're talking about my two brothers went to fight the war. I was the only boy left, and we had property from here to all the way to the river, which is about a mile west of here. So my dad, before he passed away, he told me, he says, I worked you very hard, because we had property from here to the river in one place or another. It was very hard work, but It didn't do me any harm. I think it did me some good.
So you kind of had to pick up the slack for them being gone and do the work of three sons. Can you give us a taste of what kind of work that was, what you had to do around the farm?
Yeah. You know, at the age of 10, I was operating with a team of horses. Sometimes, like over a hider, I would fall over and get hurt, and I would cry, but I would get up and and do again. But I operated a mowing machine, a horse-driven mowing machine, a horse-driven rake. And then we used to have a horse-driven baling machine. The horses would go round and round. I haven't seen a machine like that. Even when I went to Washington, D.C., what's that place where they have all that stuff?
Smithsonian?
Smithsonian Institute. Yeah. That, I didn't see that machine at all. And the other machine that I didn't see is we used to grow wheat here, just like they do in Kansas. Mm-hmm. And they had a threshing machine that they brought over to the house. We used to make two piles of wheat, and the threshing machine would be in between, and it had a tractor with a long thing to turn the thresher on. You could see that wheat coming down. It's just like gold, you know? Yeah. And my dad would take it down to Albuquerque, and they would make it into flour.
As you say that, what I hear, just reading between the lines of what you said down to Albuquerque. So you guys are actually separate from the city back then. Now it's kind of one big metropolis, but there was some space between Los Ranchos and Albuquerque proper back then?
Yeah, this was a community. Alameda is next door. My birth certificate said I was born in Alameda, but I wasn't. I was born in Los Ranchos. But my grandfather was very active in building the church. He helped build the church that's there now. He brought rocks from the mountains to put the foundation. In those days, they didn't use concrete. You know, they just used rock and mortar.
And I've got a couple questions just even before we get into your Navy time. I always hear from veterans about what it meant for them to come home from the war, to see their mother again, to see their father again, to see their family again. I don't often get to hear from the other side of it. So when you're a boy and your brothers actually make it home from World War II, do you remember what that meant to you and the family?
I was very, very proud because I followed, even as young as I was, I followed the war. We didn't have any TV, but we had a radio, and I would listen to the radio. When my brothers came back, I was very proud of them. I wish we'd have had that when I come back from Korea. I wasn't as popular as they were.
I had the privilege of sitting down with your brother and hearing his story from the Marine Corps, and he showed me, you know, where he got hit. And it seemed pretty miraculous that he survived what he went through. Did that kind of blow your mind as a kid to have him tell you that story, or did he keep all that to himself?
You know, I heard it last night. I heard some of the things. Most of it he had told me, but some of it I hadn't heard before. But one thing that he didn't mention is that when he was going in his boat, a missile hit in front of the boat, and the boat went up like this a little bit and then down. If it had been a split second more, it would have hit the boat, and it would have blown them to pieces, you know. So, and he said that the driver just went over to another place where the Japanese wouldn't be so easy target, you know.
Life is a fragile balance. So you get your brothers back, and then you're coming of age, so you say, I don't want to get drafted into the Army, I'm going into the Navy. Tell me about that. What was your welcome to the Navy? What did they do with you once you went in?
I went to boot camp, and I was lucky. I went in October of 48, and I was lucky enough to come home for Christmas. I graduated from boot camp, and I came home for Christmas. I went back to San Diego, Coronado Island, yeah. Huh? It was an amphib place. So I was in the amphibs in the Navy. The amphibs are the ones that go and take in the soldiers and Marines. They put me on an LST, landing ship tank, a little over a month, and then I went into a flagship. We hated that ship because they had admirals, high-ranking admirals there. When the higher-ranking admirals would come, we had to work in an undressed blues, and that was very uncomfortable because it was hot enough without the, and you had to use a sweater and all that. Yeah, and then from there, I went to Seattle, Washington, and I got discharged from there, 1949. Because I went in 1948 and got out in 49, 1 year later.
Until the Korean War started and they called you back up because you were in the reserve still?
Yeah, they, like I said before, North Korea had news for me. They invaded South Korea, so I was going to meetings here for the active reserves, and there would be about, I don't know, a dozen people there. The next time there'd be maybe eight, the next time maybe four. I think by then they pulled me in. So I had to serve two more years.
And I want to ask you a bunch about that, but something came to mind first. As I look back chronologically, we've got to talk about this harmonica, because so much of your life, especially in recent years, has revolved around that instrument. And it was when you were a teenager that you first fell in love with the harmonica, the mouth harp. Tell me how that developed. How did you get introduced to this instrument that you've spent so much of your life performing on?
I was 15 years old when the war ended, and this Garcia family of 11 children, four fought in Germany. One of them hit a harmonica factory, because the Germans, they're the ones that are very famous for harmonicas. He brought a little sack full of harmonicas, and I bought one, and I started fooling around with it. I didn't have a teacher or anybody that would tell me how to play it. I found out that you had a inhale and an exhale, and without going sideways, there's two different sounds. And then if you go sideways, you get another sound. So I learned all that. When I give somebody, tell somebody how to play the harmonica, I usually tell them to play the Silent Night. But with me, I learned to play Pop Goes the Whistle. That was the first one. Yeah, and you go one lyric at a time, and then you go the wrong way, and then you finally go to the right lyric until you can play the whole song, and then you play another song until I learn how to play it.
So I'm just putting it all together here. Without World War II and your friends the Garcias fighting over there, and one of them bringing back this bag full of harmonicas that was the spoils of war that he brought back from a German harmonica factory, you might never have played it.
That's correct, because I think you told me that one of your parents used to play the harmonica?
My dad used to play, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the reason for that was a lot of people in those days, they bought harmonicas because they were cheaper. They couldn't afford an accordion or a trumpet or a guitar, so they would buy a harmonica. I don't know if I would have done that or not. You know, I might have. I may have not ever played the harmonica if it hadn't been for World War II.
And a whole lot of people would have missed out on some very moving moments. If you're listening today on our affiliate in Albuquerque, KIVA 1600 on your AM dial, otherwise known as the Rock of Talk, make sure you are at the pit for the University of New Mexico basketball game on Saturday, March the 1st, because Jake will be there with his harmonica. When we come back, we're going to hear some of his Navy memories and also something he helped build that millions of visitors to Albuquerque have enjoyed in all the years since. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 94-year-old Navy veteran Jake Griego. You can find photos and videos with Jake on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and you can watch him perform the national anthem on his harmonica again at the New Mexico Lobos basketball game on Saturday, March 1st. Jake had two older brothers survive World War II, one in Europe, one in the Pacific, and Jake fulfilled his Navy service a few years later.
Let's talk some more about the Navy. So when they call you back up during the Korean War, what did they do with you? What kind of ship were you on, and where did they send you?
I went to San Francisco, Treasure Island. I was worried because they took me in for an indefinite period, and I asked the chief petty officer, how long do you think this war is going to last? And he said, it probably lasts forever. I couldn't hardly sleep that night. And then I could hear the horn of the Alcatraz. I could hear the horn. I think I was more nervous and feeling more sorry for myself than the prisoners. I could hear that all night long. But, yeah. Okay, and then from San Francisco, they flew me to San Diego. I went I can't remember the name of the ship. It was just tied up. It wouldn't go anywhere. From there, I had to go over to USS Belgrove to put it in commission. We had to take it out on trials and clean it up and get it ready for service. Yeah.
What kind of ship is the Belgrove?
An LSD, landing ship dock. It had a big tail in the back that we would drop, and then we would sink the ship. And we would get three LCBIs in there with Marines and tanks and everything. And then we would work the ballast where the water would go out, and then we would take off with the Marines and tanks and so on.
So you practiced that down in San Diego, and then they sent you overseas, but not to Korea. And a lot of people think of the Korean War and they think, oh, well, that's the only place that things were happening. But American forces were all over the globe, including you.
Yeah, let me tell you something. Before we went, because we went around the Panama Canal and to the East Coast. But before that, we were anchored outside on the ocean side of San Diego. We dropped the anchor. It was very, we had a chief petty officer and an enlisted man always on watch. They didn't know that the ship was moving because it was very, very foggy. And they didn't know, they have any idea that the chain had broken from the anchor. The current was taking us, was moving us until they saw a light. And there wasn't supposed to be a light close by. It was an LST that was there. Right before we hit it, they sounded the alarm. People got up cussing because we thought it was a drill. And I went up to the top and I put on my, I used to have that big, because I was a gunner's mate. Uh-huh. And I had that big helmet and I put on my life jacket. And then I noticed a light. Well, what the heck is this light doing here? And then I heard the word, we're about to ram another ship, you know. And get the fenders ready. A fender is rope. About this big like that. We use it when we go against the dock, it cushions it. Well, we were trying to lower the thing and the Alistair, the gun tub would come at us, you know, and we would run back. There was a mean officer there. One of my buddies was right next to me. His name was Montgomery, they call him Monkey. And when we went back one time to him, he says, Monkey, he says, you come back one more time, I'm going to start a shoe factory up here. So we were afraid of him, and we were afraid of this thing coming at us.
You were caught in the middle.
Yeah. So they finally got the, because the firemen and all that, they had to go down and get the motor started, you know, and we finally got away from it. And the next, we went out to sea without an anchor. We came back, and they send a diver down there the next day and hook it up. But I can't figure out because those chains are about that big like that, you know.
Pretty thick links there. Yeah. So for it to snap is not...
It's been sitting there since World War II, so I guess it got rusty or whatever.
So you had a little excitement before you even left the States.
Yeah. And then we made a few trips back and forth in the Pacific, and then finally they decided to send us to the East Coast. And we went through the Panama Canal. That was very interesting. You're down in the Pacific. You go into the first thing, same thing. They fill up and they start putting the ship up.
The locks of the Panama Canal to change the level.
Big, gigantic door closed behind you. Big gigantic doors open in front, and you go into that, and then they close the doors behind you, and then you keep going up. Three times we did that. When you get up on top, you're looking down at the Pacific like you were on top of a mountain somewhere in a ship. You know? It was quite an experience. Yeah. We went through the Panama Canal. Most of it was just narrow enough where two ships would go by. And then it would widen up, you know, like a lake, and then it would narrow again. And then we went into the Atlantic, and we went up to Norfolk, Virginia.
And at that point, had you guys hit any wacky weather at all aboard ship that tossed you to and fro?
No, the Pacific, you know, it goes by its name. They name it the Pacifico, so it wasn't bad. And then from there, we were going to go to Greenland. Nobody was real excited about going to Greenland. We left Norfolk about maybe 2-3 hours, and all of a sudden it looked like the ship hit something. I thought we hit a submarine because it shook real bad. And what happened, one of the screws gave out, and the thing was hitting the ship, you know, making noise. And then I was up topside, and I noticed the ship turned back. So that was the best thing that happened to us, because they sent us to Baltimore for a complete fix. They fixed it enough where we became eligible to go to the Mediterranean. My watch was a helmsman. I had to be on the helm, you know, driving the ship. When we were underway, I had to be on watch from 8 to 12 at night. And the next night, it was 12 to 4 in the morning. The next night, it was 4 to 6 in the morning. So you were losing lots of sleep. And one time, I was it was real calm. And I was sleepy, so I'd go over to one side, and the ship would go to the side. And then I would wake up, and I'd see the indicator, and I'd go the other way. And then the captain's voice came down and says, "Helms, you're wiggling like a damn fish. Straighten this thing up." Boy, from then on, I wouldn't miss a single thing on the... They have a thing they have to go by, you know. So we went to the Mediterranean. We hit almost every port there. Naples was the main port. We go from Naples, and then we go to another port. But yeah, we got to go to Sicily, Palermo, Sicily, Catania, Sicily. We saw the Rock of Gibraltar. And then about 300 and maybe more sailors and Marines, and we went in buses to Rome. It cost us $23 to go to Rome. You probably couldn't make the paperwork for that much, you know? But, yeah, we had 3 days in Rome. One of the days, we got to go to the big church there and have an audience with Pope Pius XII, the one that was Roosevelt and Hitler and Mussolini and Prime Minister Winston Churchill, yeah.
So you had an audience with the Pope?
We had an audience with the Pope. He could speak, I think they said 7 languages or something like that. He would go from one language to another.
Sounds like quite an adventure for a young kid from Los Ranchos.
That came to my mind. I said, me from New Mexico? I'm over here seeing all this. I wish I'd have had a camera, because every time I see something like that place where they used to throw the people into the lions, what they call it?
Coliseum,
yeah. Every time I see something like that, I say, I'm not going to forget this, and I'm not going to forget that, and I'm not going to forget the other thing. But now it's just like a dream, you know.
And I guess I've got to ask, too, while you're there in the Mediterranean, was there any concern that, you know, you said you're a gunner's mate. Is there any concern that you guys are going to have to man your guns or have general quarters or have any military function?
Well, what happened is we were having a Cold War with Russia, and I forget what it was one time that we heard from the captain, said that it was, he says that we're sitting in the middle of a boiling pot. Russia had, I don't know whether they threatened to invade something or something. So they told us to put live ammunition on our guns. And I said, wow, this has to happen when I'm here? But now it turned out to be that. Later on, we got used to that, because almost all the time, you know, we were putting ammunition. It was like a threat happening all the time.
I'm glad you brought that up, because especially for people my age and younger who didn't live through that time, we don't know what didn't happen. We hear about what happened. Yeah. But sometimes what almost happened or could have happened is just as intense. And it sounds like you guys were on regular alert. You had to be prepared that war could break out there with the USSR at any moment.
Yeah, yeah. We used to. And one time we had the experience of, I was a gun captain on a 40 millimeter. And one of the guns had a misfire. A misfire is when the pin hits the thing, but it doesn't go off. And it could explode any minute. So they chose two people to be there. Well, one of them, his name was Korn. He was a very smart gunner's mate. He went in there to take the thing out. And he would give it to me, and I would throw it over the side. But before that, they passed a word. Everybody from gun number two, stay away from there, because they didn't know the thing was going to explode. Ooh. And when they passed that, I said, uh-oh. Me and Korn were the only two there. Mm-hmm. So he went in there and got the thing and gave it to me. And I only had to make about three or four steps, but it seemed like I was going in slow motion because I wanted to get rid of that. If that thing blew up, it probably blew my head off, you know. And even after I threw it over the side, I went like that. So I bet it would blow up and I'd get killed. Yeah. And that's about the, you know, I didn't go to, thank God, like my two brothers did and Warren. They went through a lot more.
I understand that when you came back to the States shortly before your discharge, you got yourself in a little bit of trouble because you're such a baseball fan. Is that true? And I understand you umpired Little League baseball around here. You helped found one of the local Little Leagues in the Albuquerque area. But back during the Korean War, you had to sneak off and watch a World Series game in the Big Apple?
Yeah, that's what could have got me in trouble. But I went to... See, in the Navy, you have a... One time you had to... On the weekend, you had to stay on the ship. That's duty. The next one, if you're in port, you have a 48-hour pass. On the next one, you have a 72-hour pass. And I was so lucky that I had a 72-hour pass when the World Series was going on. So I hitchhiked all the way to, I think it was Baltimore, and I couldn't get out of there, so I had to take a bus and go to New York.
So you hitchhike from Norfolk to Baltimore, yeah, and then hop a bus to New York.
When I got to New York, I got the day that it was a Saturday's game. I got on the subway, and we traveled, and I thought, like, being from New Mexico, I thought we were going to come out in the middle of a prairie somewhere. But what happens there is subway is it's in underground, and then it goes up like this, and you're standing over here looking down at the Yankee Stadium, and I was so worried. I'm a pessimist. Maybe they'll be fooled. I won't be able to go in. I was in a hurry, and this guy says, "Hey, sailor, come here." He gave me a ticket for Saturday's game, and I wish I'd have gotten his name and sent him a card for Christmas or something, but.
Just because you were in uniform, he had an extra ticket. He saw you and gave it to you.
Yeah, the only thing I remember, he had a top coat and a hat and looked like kind of like an FBI, you know. But the only thing I could say is thank you, you know. So I went ahead and I bought the ticket for the next day, Sunday, and I watched Saturday and Sunday's game. I think in that story over there that you saw, it tells you when the ninth inning, the Yankees hit a home run and tied the game. So they went to extra innings, and I was supposed to leave there so I could be in time aboard ship. So I said, the heck with it. I haven't messed up. I only had a few days to get discharged, and I never messed up any. I was always on time and everything. So I said, the heck with it. I never messed up. I'm gonna be late, but I'm going to watch the full game. So I watched the full game and took the bus back, got there late. The captain, I had to go to Captain's Mass, but when he heard that I was from a small village in New Mexico, I guess he felt sorry for me. And he didn't give me extra duty, because extra duty was chipping paint and painting and all that. Yeah. So I was lucky.
So it was worth it?
Oh, yeah.
And let's talk about that World Series, because this is the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Yankees. I mean, half the guys on that field are Hall of Famers, weren't they? Who were some of the players that you got to see?
Joe DiMaggio, Phil Rizzuto, Don Newcomb. I can't remember the name of the Dodger, the outfielder. They were making some real nice catches.
Duke Snider?
Duke Snider. And Jackie Robinson, he would be on third base, and he would jump back and forth. And an ordinary player doesn't do that because a pitcher can time you. And you know, that ball travels fast and it can get you, but they wouldn't dare throw, because if they threw to third base, Jackie Robinson was still home. I think it happened one time, but anyway, yeah. I know he stole home one time. But, that was quite something to see Jackie Robinson, you know, and DiMaggio. And
Yogi Berra, Mickey Mantle.
Yogi Berra, Mickey Mantle, and all of
Were you going for the Yankees or the Dodgers?
I was a Yankee fan, yeah. Huh? I love baseball. I did a lot of umpiring.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, a taste of what this 94-year-old has been up to since he got out of the Navy and how long he plans to continue his patriotic performances on the harmonica. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is. Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 94-year-old Jake Griego of Los Ranchos de Albuquerque in northern New Mexico. If you'd like to hear the Marine Corps memories of his late Purple Heart recipient brother Leo, you can access that episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Jake was a few years younger, and he ended up serving in the Navy during the Korean War. So you get out of the Navy and you come back home, and as we talked about earlier, you've been back in this part of town ever since. So what did you do for work when you got out of the Navy?
I had worked for the railroad. I went back to work for the railroad, and I didn't like it because it was very dirty. So I talked to my brother. He was a union carpenter. If he would talk to big boss, if he'd get me in, and he talked to him and he said, "Yeah, bring him in." So I went in as a union carpenter, and I loved it. I loved from building forms to the foundation to the walls to the ceiling, making stairs. I specialized in concrete steps. Mm. I used to, from one story to another. Uh-huh. You know, I had a whole week to prepare for a pour. I worked in the city jail. the county jails. I forget that big building downtown. I worked in banks. But the most interesting of all where I worked was at building the tramway.
So for people who don't know, it's one of the big tourist spots in Albuquerque. You can take the tram from Albuquerque up to the Sandia Crest and ride a gondola, basically, back and forth, up and down. So what did you build on the tramway?
I rode the helicopter taking the cables up there. I had a certain place that I had to take care of. I had a radio and everything. In case, if we had trouble, I would report it. It took us a month for each cable. Each cable was over 3 miles long.
Wow.
You know, you should have seen the spools way, very, 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 very big spools, because it was a continuous cable all the way to the top. And it took us a month for each cable to go up there, yeah. What they called is the first tower, and then the second tower, that's what took so long, because the German engineers, I think they were Swiss engineers, I call them German because they spoke German a lot. They would, they had to transfer the cable from, into the right place and everything. I was up on top with the radio, and because I had to give the word to the guy that was pulling the cables up. And then the way it started, they were going to have a helicopter get the cable and go over there, and then another helicopter would take it and go as far as they could and drop it. Well, it didn't work because they got tangled up in all the trees and everything. So they had to have the iron workers go from the top to the bottom. They started very, very early in the morning because that mountain is rough. And they finally, it was like a clothesline. And the clothesline, they tied it to a 3/8 cable. The 3/8 cable, they tied it to a 3/4 cable. The 3/4 cable, they tied it to the carrying cables, the ones that would carry the, but anyway, yeah, and like I say, all that took a long time.
Did you ever think this isn't going to work, or it's not going to go the way they want it to?
No, I had an idea that it would, The thing about the second tower, your tower usually goes up like this. But the second tower was like this.
Instead of a 90-degree angle, they had to lean it?
Because the cable was at a 90 going up. Uh-huh. See? If it was like this, they might knock it down. So if the iron workers, they would go up, and then they would go down, they wouldn't go up. I'd rather quit than go up, because it seemed like it was going to fall.
Uh-huh.
But that's the way it was meant to be, for it to work.
So anybody who's listening to this who comes and rides the tramway to the summit, they can thank you.
Yeah. A critical point was a point I was trying to think of a while ago. Because the cars would go close to that, and we had to dynamite it. Another thing about the cables, you would think that they're tied to something permanent. They're not. They're... We used to have to go down seven stories down and do big, big, gigantic blocks. And when the snow hits the cables and it brings it down, those things go up.
Yeah.
And you sometimes you see them up there, and sometimes you see it down. But
so it's a weight and pulley system. And what you're saying is, because of the snow, if it was just attached to the earth, it would snap or pull out. But because it's adjustable at the base with these weights, it can give.
Yeah, it has give. And one time, I was like I said, I was a carpenter, and they told me to build something that was before the trolleys were going up, where the cable would go through. They told me to put plywood around it, and I did. And then a big snow came, and it knocked the plywood and the wall and everything down. And I don't know, have you heard the name Ben Abruzzo? Ben Abruzzo was very, very, he used to go on these balloons. Anyway, he and another were started the tramway, and he was up there trying to knock the snow from the, a little bit of cable. He was so excited. He thought we were going to lose the whole thing. Yeah, but thank God that we didn't, you know.
That's touched a lot of lives in all the years since you did that. And I know your harmonica playing has done the same thing. And I didn't ask you, I'm assuming you did, but were you playing that harmonica aboard ship during your Navy days?
Very little. I didn't hardly play it too much.
When did you start playing the national anthem at sporting events? Because I've got a list here of a lot of different places. Let me see here. The Albuquerque Isotopes, AAA team here, the New Mexico Lobo basketball games at the Pit, the New Mexico baseball team, volleyball team. You've been at Kirtland Air Force Base for change of command ceremonies, the New Mexico State Fair Rodeo, the New Mexico State Fair Military Day, at your ship reunions in the Navy, and even at an NBA game for the Denver Nuggets. So how did all that start? When did you start playing the anthem?
My daughter, she's what they call the manager. She calls these places. And she heard me play one time. She says, why don't we take you to the Isotope? This was about 13 years ago. So I went over there. I had to audition. And they liked it right away. And then I started there. And then I had to audition for the Lobos, both girls and boys basketball games. So I've been doing both of them for 13 years. And then she called the Denver Nuggets, and they didn't want me there until she showed a video. I says, bring them over.
So I got to ask, I'm guessing for most of these years, you were just playing the harmonica for fun, right? Just to, it was therapeutic for you, or you just enjoyed playing it?
I played with a group. Sometimes there would be up to 15, 16 guitarists, and I'll be the only harmonica player. Uh-huh. Sometimes there'd be an accordionist. But I played in Bernalillo. I played in all kinds of different, in the South Valley, in North Valley. I played in about, I'd say half a dozen different places with a group, you know. Mm-hmm. This took a lot of years, maybe. Mm-hmm. I started about 18 years ago.
And, I mean, I have to ask you how long you're going to keep doing it, but before we get to that, what's it feel like when you hit that last note of the national anthem and a sold-out crowd at the Pit or an NBA arena in Denver, they all cheer?
Yeah.
What's that feel like?
It feels, I feel very, very patriotic that I did it, you know, because I'll have a lot of fun doing it. And I think about the wonderful nation that I live in when I play it, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I play it for the four military songs for all the soldiers, especially World War II mainly. I have to think of the soldiers and Marines and sailors that didn't come back in this community. We had quite a few of them. And then New Mexico was very famous for, I think per capita, we had more of the prisoners than in World War II.
The Bataan Death March had more from New Mexico than any other state, and you have the Bataan Memorial Park here.
Yeah, I talked to one of them that came back. He was a prisoner for about 3 years. He could speak Spanish, and there was a Japanese there that could speak Japanese. I mean, speak Spanish rather. He was going to get on this ship. They were going to transfer them from the Philippines to Japan. And the Japanese spoke Spanish, told this guy, he says, why don't you take the other ship? They're going to have officers over there. They may have better treatment. Well, the ship that he was going to get on had the Japanese flag, and a submarine sank it. No survivors. He would have gone.
And a lot of prisoners did die that way on those hell ships going to Japan. So that Japanese soldier who could speak Spanish saved his life.
Saved his life, yeah.
And you're saying that even when you're out there playing the anthem, you're thinking about guys like that?
I always think about the people that, especially the ones that died, you know. They didn't come back.
So how long are you going to keep doing this?
I don't know how much longer. Right now, I have to take my walker. And I think a lot of the, because I get an ovation and doesn't quit, and I think a lot of it has to do with the Korea hat and my age, you know, because they sound as a 94-year-old Jake Griggle, you know.
Yeah? So you're not quitting yet?
Oh, no. Yeah, I'm going to keep playing as long as I can, I guess. But my balance is getting real bad. Mm. Yeah, I was standing right here, and I went facing this way, and I went back. Mm. Boom. I couldn't get up.
I got to ask you this. I know this wasn't your idea to begin with. Your daughter roped you into it, but it seems like you enjoy it now and it's meaningful to you. Is there a game or a venue that you haven't played the anthem in yet that you'd really like to someday?
Oh, sure. I'd like to be able to, in the World Series or the football, what do you call it?
Super Bowl.
Yeah. I'd like to do that. It doesn't bother me. They asked me, when I played in Denver for the Nuggets, don't you get nervous? I don't get nervous. I said, that's why I have my daughter. I let her get nervous. her and her husband, they get tickets. I said, I'm playing. Each person is just one person that I'm playing to. You know, I don't play for a whole group. Everybody's one person.
You know, that's really good advice that I hope people heard, because a lot of people do get performance anxiety. Mm-hmm. And that's something, you know, the great baseball announcer Vin Scully used to say, when I'm calling a ball game, mm-hmm. I'm talking to one person. Mm-hmm. And you're saying you're playing that harmonica for one person.
Yeah, I'm playing harmonica for one person. One time, I don't know how it happened. I've been playing for about 4 years, and I started getting nervous in a girls' basketball game. And I was getting angry with myself. I said, I've been playing here for 4 years. Why am I getting nervous now? And then I talked to the gal. I got into conversation with the gal to tell me where to go, where to stand, when to start, and all that. Yeah. And I got into a conversation with her, and I forgot my nervousness. Yeah. But as a whole, I don't get nervous.
So who knows? Maybe they'll invite you to a major league ballpark one of these days. Maybe you'll get to go play in Yankee Stadium. What would that be? If it were this year, that would be 73 years after you got in trouble for going to the World Series.
Yeah, in 1952. Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't ask you about your honor flight to Washington, D.C. You got to go with other veterans from here in northern New Mexico. What was the best part of that trip for you, and what did it mean to you?
Well, we got to see the monuments over there. Yeah, all that was pretty, very, very interesting, yeah.
Did you play your harmonica at all on that trip?
Yeah, they had me play. I played the four military songs.
Well, one thing I don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for touching so many hearts and honoring your fellow veterans the way you do when you perform the anthem. When you think back over 94, almost 95 years, is there something you'd say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I've been thankful for having good health. You know, up to maybe a few months ago, I started getting, you know, I fell a couple of times. But I'm thankful for, I have a super daughter that takes care of me. She does everything, mm-hmm. from one thing to another. She makes sure that I, you know, for the all the appointments that I have with doctors and so on. I'm very lucky to have a family support.
And you can join his family in supporting Jake March the 1st if you're in the Albuquerque area when he again will play the national anthem at the Pit. Enjoy those photos and videos of Jake on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and I hope you'll join us again next time when we'll be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.